I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hyperthetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hyperthetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hyperthetical, HyperThetical.
Hello, and welcome to the Vulgar History Podcast. My name is Anne Foster, and this is a pandemic super special mini episode where we're going to be looking at a past pandemic in global history and what people did about it at the time. And today we're going to be looking at smallpox, which is a disease that has been around for a very long time. So we're looking specifically at the events that led to the development of the smallpox vaccine, because just so you know, smallpox has been completely eradicated. And if for some whatever reason it comes back, a vaccine exists. So that's good news. Smallpox was officially declared eradicated on May 8th, 1980. So, that long ago. 40 years ago-ish. So, the sources I used to prepare this mini-episode were a book called Get Well Soon, History's Worst Plagues and the Heroes Who Fought Them by Jennifer Wright, which is a great book. And I'm probably going to find, as I was reading through it, it's just a bunch of really interesting sort of anecdotes, stories about different pandemics, etc. And I kept finding things in that book that made me think would be good minisodes, so I'm sure I'll be citing that again later. Also an article in Gizmodo by Kiona Smith Strickland called Princesses, Slaves, and Explosives, The Scandalous Origin of Vaccines. I got some info from Wikipedia, and then also an article from Smithsonian.com, which I'll explain a bit more what that was about when we get to that part of the story. So, what is smallpox? So, the thing is that smallpox, you get a dangerously high fever accompanied by headaches, back pain, and vomiting. Painful sores open in your mouth and nose, and a rash spreads all over your body. Blisters form and fill with pus. These pustules eventually scab over and dry up. And it has a fatality rate of about 30%. So, about 30% of people who catch smallpox at all will die, and the rest will live with scars left behind by the pustules. Somewhat famously, Queen Elizabeth I had a run-in with smallpox, and there was a whole thing where it seemed like she was going to die, and this is when she was still pretty young, and the whole thing was like, but who will be her heir? And it was a whole drama. She recovered, but the scars from the smallpox are, and I haven't double-checked this, I'm just telling you this based on what I read somewhere. I believe that because of the scars, that's why she started wearing so much thick white makeup. And the makeup was, of course, lead-based. And that was a whole other scenario. So smallpox, horrible things happen with it when you catch it. So it's caused by the variola virus. Let's see. So chicken pox, which is caused by a different virus, bears some resemblance and rarely kills anyone. But one of the reasons that the death rate is so much higher for smallpox versus chickenpox is that smallpox makes your immune system go nuts. You die because your immune system kills you. So the technical term is an uncontrolled immune response. Your immune system identifies an intruding virus or bacteria, and in its attempt to rid the body of the danger, basically freaks out. Chemicals are released in the bloodstream to fight the infection and trigger inflammation throughout the body. Organs are compromised and may shut down. If your immune system attacks your heart and your heart stops pumping blood effectively, your cells don't have oxygen, and you die. If it attacks your kidneys, your blood can't be purified and you die. So it's been a thing. We'll get to it for a very long time. This is a thing that killed a lot of people. We're not talking about the whole history of smallpox, but it was a big part of the Spanish conquest of Central America, in the sense that the Spanish people brought over the germs for smallpox, and something like 95% of the indigenous people died. But also well into the 18th century, something like 400,000 people in Europe would die of smallpox as well. The thing about it, though, is that people who survived smallpox, those like other 70%, developed immunity, and a small degree of immunity could be passed down through parents, which is interesting. One of the reasons, perhaps, why it was so especially deadly for the Inca and Aztec people when they encountered the Spanish, is that smallpox, like so many illnesses, is thought to have originated with farm animals, especially cattle, but also horses and sheep, and then crossed species to infect humans. And the thing is that in European culture, just culturally, they had a lot of contact with animals. Like there was the animals, horses, etc., would sleep in barns, and there might be people close to those barns and stuff. Whereas the Inca and Aztec people had very little to no contact with those animals. There was llamas, but the llamas just kind of hung out in the mountains, so there wasn't that close relationship. So the disease just wouldn't have manifested there in the same way until the Spanish invaded. But again, that is not what today's mini episode is about, because this is just a mini episode. I can't get into every outbreak of smallpox, but that was a notable and horrifying one. So, as far back as ancient Roman times, it was understood that people who had survived smallpox once did not get the disease again. So there were various of types of things that people thought you could do to make yourself not get sick, and one of those methods is what became known as variolation, so which is sort of exposing people who don't have smallpox to some bodily fluid from people who currently have smallpox. So this practice seems to have sprung up independently in several places in India, China, West Africa, and elsewhere. In 570 AD, people in Europe started calling it variolation, which comes from the Latin name for smallpox, variola. And remember, it comes from the variola virus. So variolation usually meant rubbing pus from a smallpox pustule, a good ripe one, the runnier the better, into a cut or scratch on a healthy person's arm. And although the method in China was that people would soak a cotton ball in infected pus and stick it up their noses. So the effect of it is to expose people to a controlled amount of smallpox in the hopes that they would develop immunity to it and then be immune to it forever, because people who had had smallpox were less likely to get it again. Other methods of transfer might include rubbing infected bits of scab on open wounds or snorting smallpox crusts up your nose. The uninfected person would usually develop the disease, but in a less severe form. So, I mean, you'd still have a higher chance of dying of smallpox if you had variolation treatment, but less of a chance than if you just caught smallpox in the wild, effectively. So, in the northern Caucasus Mountains, women of the Circassian ethnic group traditionally inoculated their children at about 6 months using this variolation technique, and the Circassian women carried this knowledge with them when they were trafficked to Turkey as sex slaves, which was a common fate for many Circassians up until the early 20th century. So what would happen? Here it's a descriptor. So the French philosopher Voltaire described the situation in 1778. The Circassians are poor, and their daughters are beautiful, and indeed it is in them they chiefly trade. They furnish with beauties the seraglios of the Turkish Sultan, of the Persian Sophie, and of all those who are wealthy enough to purchase and maintain such precious merchandise. So these were legendarily attractive-looking women who became members of the harem of the Turkish Sultan. So the women who ended up in the Ottoman Sultan's harem, they left their mark on Turkish culture, which is this technique of variolation that they were one of many cultural groups who had discovered it and had been using it for quite a while. So again, Voltaire says, "The Turks, who are people of good sense, soon adopted this custom, inasmuch as that there is not a bassa in Constantinople, but communicates the smallpox to his children of both sexes immediately upon their being weaned." Inoculation first caught on in Turkey in the late 1600s because of the Circassian women, and we're going to see what happened from there on. So the injection would be done on, as well, young girls who are being considered for the harem. The injection would be done on parts of the body where, even if there were some scarring, it would be less likely to mar their beauty, which was what was most literally valuable about them, because they were being treated as merchandise, these girls. Smallpox was a killer, but it was also referred to as a beauty's enemy. People would lose their good looks. Their face would get these scars on it. Some people would lose their sight and become blind. Let's see. And then also, variolation wasn't, like, super safe, obviously. It would help some people not get smallpox later, but also you could have a severe reaction to the smallpox sample and die. There was a 2-3% fatality rate from variolation, but again, the fatality rate of smallpox itself is 30%, so it was risky for sure, but it did seem to help a lot of people. And then, so in December of 1715, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu was the daughter of an English duke and the wife of a member of parliament who, side note, she'd eloped to marry this parliamentarian a couple of years earlier because to avoid marrying another person, and the person she didn't want to marry was named Clotworthy Skeffington, which is quite a British sounding name. She was witty, she was beauty, she was the toast of King George I's court, and then she caught smallpox, but her beauty was destroyed or whatever. But that's okay. She was fine otherwise. So she left London in 1716 with her husband to go to Turkey, where her husband was the king's new ambassador to the Ottoman court. And while there, she observed this tradition of the harem girls who were inoculating their children, perhaps one another, with this variolation type treatment. So the way that she described it, Mary Montagu said, "There is a set of old women who make it their business to perform the operation every autumn in the month of September, when the great heat is abated. People send to one another to know if any of their family has a mind to have the smallpox. They make parties for this purpose, and when they are all met, commonly 15 or 16 together, the old woman comes with a nutshell full of the matter of the best sort of smallpox," so just like a nutshell full of pus, "and asks which vein you please to have opened. She immediately rips open that you offer to her with a large needle, which gives you no more pain than a common scratch, and puts into the vein as much matter as can lie on the head of her needle, and after that binds up the little wound with a hollow bit of shell, and in this manner opens 4 or 5 veins." So Mary Montagu saw this happen and saw that it was working, that it was successful. So she convinced the embassy surgeon, because she was there as the ambassador's wife, she convinced the embassy surgeon to variolate her own 5-year-old son, Edward, and the procedure went well, and she was now a woman on a mission. So again, Mary's own words were, "I am patriot enough to take pains to bring this useful invention into fashion in England, and I should not fail to write to some of our doctors very particularly about it, if I knew any one of them that I had thought had virtue enough to destroy such a considerable branch of their revenue for the good of mankind. But that distemper is too beneficial to them not to expose to all their resentment the hardy wight that should undertake to put an end to it. Perhaps if I live to return, I may, however, have courage to war with them." So she knew that doctors would not be into this, but she just saw for the betterment of all mankind, as she phrased it, that this was going to be her mission. She wanted to help prevent more deaths from smallpox. So she got Charles Maitland, who, again, is the embassy surgeon. She just sounds like a very persuasive woman. So she got the embassy surgeon to inoculate Devariolate, her four-year-old daughter, in a demonstration for the royal physicians. It worked. And in August, King George gave Maitland permission to conduct a trial of the technique on prisoners in London's Newgate Prison. So this is all, you know, happening outside of any sort of, like, regulations for the safety of vaccine testing. But the good news is it helped people. So six men from the prison volunteered on the promise of the king's pardon for the survivors. So for them, the deal was, you know, get this treatment, and if you don't die, you'll be freed from prison. So they're like, sure. And guess what? It survived. So all six prisoners survived and later proved to be immune to smallpox. And so they moved to the next stage of testing. So Maitland, again, this doctor, began testing the inoculation. Again, it's just like, ooh, the methods are like, bleh. But this is what they did. So he went on to test on orphan children, who were slightly less expendable than convicted criminals. And the orphans also survived. So then he moved on to inoculating princesses. So what happened here is that in April of 1722, so the king was clearly very into this, and Maitland inoculated the daughters of the Princess of Wales. After that, inoculation started to catch on in England and elsewhere. So King Frederick II of Prussia had all of his soldiers treated, as did George Washington at Valley Forge in 1778. People in France were more resistant to the procedure, causing Voltaire to fume. Had variolation been practiced in France, it would have saved the lives of thousands. And then, so variolation, that is the journey of this injecting people with a little bit of the live virus and how that would save a lot of people. And then we move into vaccination. So in 1774, a Dorset cattle farmer named Benjamin Jesty, along with two of his female servants, Anne Notley and Mary Reed, had been infected with a disease called cowpox. So cowpox is a disease that happened to cows. And when humans got it, it wasn't as deadly as smallpox. It was sort of like a very mild version of smallpox. So, and the people who often would get cowpox were people like milkmaids, like dairymaids, like people who were there milking cows, etc. So when an epidemic of smallpox came through town, Benjamin Jesty decided to try to give his wife Elizabeth and two eldest sons immunity by infecting them with cowpox. Because the thing is that people he saw, and other people did, we'll talk about them too in a minute, a seeming connection between cowpox and smallpox, such that people who had had cowpox before tended to not get smallpox later. So Benjamin Jesty infected his wife and two eldest sons with cowpox. He took his family to a cow at a farm in a nearby town that had the disease, and using a darning needle, transferred pustular material from the cow by scratching their arms. The boys had mild local reactions and quickly recovered. And the wife, her arm became inflamed, but she also recovered. Jesse's experiment was met with hostility by his neighbors. He was labeled inhuman and was hooted at, reviled, and pelted whenever he attended markets in the neighborhood. The introduction of an animal disease into a human body was thought disgusting, and some even feared the metamorphosis into horned beasts, like the people would turn into cows. But the treatment, it was demonstrated when his sons didn't catch smallpox, even though they were exposed to it later on. The epigraph on his tombstone, and again, this man's name is Benjamin Jesty. His tombstone calls him an upright, honest man, particularly noted for having been the first person known that introduced the cowpox by inoculation, and who, from his great strength of mind, made the experiment from the cow on his wife and two sons in the year 1774. So then in 1791, a German teacher named Peter Plett inoculated three children with cowpox. He had learned about the connection from milkmaids, and when he reported his results to professors of medicine at the nearby University of Kiel, they basically ignored him, and so he just resumed his teaching career, and that was it for him. But then, another guy named Edward Jenner comes along. So, Edward Jenner had been variolated against smallpox as a child, in the traditional way, because by that point, Mary Montagu's crusade was such that it had become sort of a normal thing, that people would just be variolated. So again, having a bit of smallpox injected into children who don't have smallpox. Edward Jenner was intrigued by a dairymaid he heard declare, "I shall never have smallpox, for I have had cowpox. I shall never have an ugly, pockmarked face." So in 1796, Edward Jenner found a milkmaid with cowpox and injected the matter from one of her sores into an 8-year-old boy. The boy's name was, I have it written down here, James Phipps. So he took pus from blisters and scratches on the arm of 8-year-old James Phipps, who was the son of Jenner's gardener. After a short and mild illness, Phipps recovered and proved immune to smallpox. And so Jenner coined the term vaccination after the Latin root for from the cow, the way that vache is the French word for cow. So it means it's related to the connection between cows and saving people from smallpox, effectively. So after he had done this, word spread. So children lined up on Sundays to get scratched by a doctor, to get scratched by him. The kids were among the earliest patients ever to be given a small bit of cowpox as a way to protect them against a deadly virus known as smallpox, which killed 80% of the kids it infected in London, 3 out of every 10 people at the time. Some weeks the lineup on Edward Jenner's property grew so long that it snaked across the 1-acre property's sprawling lawn, ending at the entrance of a small thatched hut into the next to the vinery. Originally built as a reading cottage, the structure had been transformed into what Edward Jenner dubbed the Temple of Vaccinia, the site of one of Britain's first public health services. So a friend told Jenner that selling his vaccine could make him rich, but wealth wasn't what Jenner was looking for. Instead, he self-published his discoveries in 1798, documenting evidence of vaccination success for the first time. The same year he published this information, he sent vaccine material to a medical missionary in Newfoundland in Canada to carry out the first smallpox vaccinations in North America. He was met by skepticism, as did other people who, because this whole like cows to human thing, people just thought it was gross. So there was initial skepticism from the medical community, but smallpox vaccinations began across Europe, the Spanish colonies, and the newly formed United States. Napoleon Bonaparte vaccinated his troops in 1805. Thomas Jefferson vaccinated his family. In 1806, Thomas Jefferson said, "Medicine has never before produced any single improvement of such utility. You have erased from the calendar of human afflictions one of its greatest. Mankind can never forget that you have lived." So these days, the word vaccine is a generic term for any substance that causes the body to develop immunity to a disease. Usually, vaccines are made from dead or weakened forms of the virus being vaccinated against. Modern vaccines use viruses or antigens from viruses grown in cultures in a laboratory, not actual pus from people's actual blisters. In the 20th century alone, the smallpox virus killed an estimated 300 million people, according to the World Health Organization. In 1959, the group launched a global eradication program, and 40 years later, on May 8, 1980, it declared smallpox eradicated. So far, it is the only disease that has been completely wiped out in humans through a vaccination type situation. There's other diseases that were around and then mysteriously vanished, but this is one that like was actively removed. So this was the first building block on the road to safe vaccines in general, which have since been developed for many life-threatening diseases such as polio, measles, meningitis, and diphtheria. And I wanted to mention as well, so Edward Jenner, who was one of a few people who figured out this cowpox, smallpox connection, but was the one who really advocated for it and sort of made it widespread. So his former home is now a museum that is called Dr. Jenner's House. It's called Dr. Jenner's House Museum and Garden in Berkeley, England, and it's privately funded. Due to COVID-19, without visitor income, the future of this museum is at risk. So they have a crowdfunding page, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, because as they say in their video, Dr. Jenner's house needs you. So his house museum, which is, it looks like a really sweet, I've not personally been there, but when I am able to go to the United Kingdom, it's a place that I really hope to be able to visit. So at this museum, so it's at the same place where Edward Jenner carried out his pioneering research into vaccination. They celebrate his achievements and show how curiosity can change the world. So if you want to read about the museum and help support it, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But otherwise, that is the storied and interesting and surprising history of smallpox vaccination and variolation. I particularly, as a feminist historian, I appreciate how the dairy maids, how these the victims of this sex trafficking, these sex slaves, how they ended up bringing the information about this, like that their town, their area had figured this out. They brought it with them when they were trafficked. Then Mary Montague saw this happening, understood how amazing and game-changing this could be. She brought it back, convinced a bunch of people about it. Really, it paved the way for a lot of medical treatments that we have now. And again, I'm just glad in general to know that smallpox has been completely eradicated, but in case it comes back for whatever reason, there's a stockpile of the vaccine somewhere in the US, I think. Anyway, this is the Vulgar History Podcast, a mini episode. My name is Anne Foster. I hope you're all staying well, and I'll talk to you all next time.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.